Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and back with me this week, as ever, we have Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And joining us down the line today, we're delighted to welcome Spike columnist and stand-up comedian, Simon Evans.
Hello.
Coming up on today's show, we'll be discussing the German farmers' revolt, the post office scandal, and the trigger warnings on James Bond. So, Germany's farmers are up in arms. They've been blocking roads, blocking city centres, highways, all kinds of things, essentially bringing the country to a halt. Now, ostensibly, this is about a cut to certain subsidies on their fuel and on new agricultural vehicles. But Tom, as ever, there's probably something a bit deeper than that going on here.
Oh, no, definitely. And very similar to the farmers' revolts that we've seen in the Netherlands and elsewhere. Undergirding a lot of it is environmental regulations, often things that originate in the EU, and just a general sense that farmers, as well as many other people in the kind of real economy, the people who are actually involved in, you know, producing food, selling actual goods, producing energy and so on, are just being completely overlooked, if not pushed around and squashed by various governments across Europe. And it's been a remarkable kind of assertion of their right to protest and also how central they are to an economy like Germany's or to any other. I think it's been a fascinating demonstration of the fact that various governments try to push these people around, act like they don't matter. They're on their way to a kind of carbon-free future, whether they like it or not. But, you know, when you get a few thousand tractors in the middle of the road, you can really make governments sit up and take notice of you. So there already has been an attempt to kind of ameliorate the situation on the part of the government. They've done a kind of partial climb down on some of the specific measures which had triggered this particular revolt, but it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. They're going to have their biggest day of protest on Monday, where, again, they're expecting to see thousands of tractors show up in Berlin. But I think it's definitely part of a broader European story, definitely, of people in the real economy who've often been on the receiving end of the kind of lofty climate targets of the elites, demonstrating that they're not willing to put up with it anymore. And long may that continue, definitely.
Definitely. Simon, I mean, you know, we often seem to forget that, you know, the world is powered by things like fossil fuels. You know, there's a material basis to our wealth. I mean, it's bad enough that we forget how important fossil fuels, oil and gas are, but it seems even more insane to forget how important food is. You know, people are, you see these farmers holding up placards saying no farmers, no food. And you think, how could any government forget that?
Yeah, I think there has been a tendency, perhaps certainly there was before COVID for some years, to think in terms of a general drift away from some fairly traditional propositions, such as food security being a, you know, an important part of a government's job, and towards a sort of globalized mindset, which thought that it didn't really matter whether we got our meat or our corn, our cereal crops, our vegetables from Holland or from in our own backyard, or whether they were imported from Argentina or China or whatever. And I think that was possibly a foolish complacency that set in with many years of prosperity and the smooth running of global trade routes and so on. And I think the farmers are in a pretty strong position now, post-COVID and post the semi-collapse of globalized prosperity and supply routes and the inflation and so on that we've seen. Half-empty supermarket shelves are not uncommon now in Hove. I'm resisting, obviously, any kind of comment on Brexit one way or the other as an explanation, but it's obviously happening on the continent as well. It's also interesting to notice, I think, that on the continent, the farming community, for want of a better and perhaps more robust expression, are particularly well organised and tend to fight their corner in a way that you don't generally see in the United Kingdom very much. My parents live in East Anglia, which is largely a farming region, and you hardly really notice them, you know, from one visit to the next. The fields are vast now and are largely automated. All the old pubs, their local pub is called the Jolly Farmers, but I honestly have not seen one, jolly or otherwise, in there for many years, you know, and it feels like it's almost become an abstract proposition that somehow this land is used to generate foodstuffs. But obviously on the continent, you know, the French farmers are very well known for being more than happy to block the roads to the ports and the docks if they don't get their way. The Dutch farmers quite recently were equally vociferous, and now the Germans are showing their strength. And I have to say, I quite like it. You know, it does remind you, as you say, who does the real work and who has a pretty fundamental, you know, pinch point that they can apply if they feel that they are being expected to put up with too much of the you know, the, yes, the net zero thing is definitely part of it, and also just generally a disregard for people whose livelihood is not perhaps quite as glamorous or as 21st century as others that, you know, capture people's imagination a bit more.
Yeah, and Tom, certainly in Holland, and you know, you brought up the Dutch farmers there, we've seen how politicized this has become, how actually it's been a fuel of populist politics more broadly, going beyond the sort of farming issue.
No, definitely. And it's been interesting, as you were saying, Simon, about how this isn't something that you would normally see in Britain, but it's something that you see in continental Europe. You read a lot of the press coverage, and it's often talking about this is not the sort of thing that Germany would usually experience, that they tend to not rise up in this kind of way, in the way that their neighbours in France might do. I think it is also kind of reminiscent of the fact when push comes to shove, people feel like they've got no option. And even in the UK, I was sort of reminded of things like the fuel duty protests in the early 2000s, which also involved farmers to a certain degree, but it was mainly hauliers. I mean, they brought the country to a standstill in a way that Just Stop Oil or all these other disruptive protesters could never dream of doing, because they actually have a pinch point and actually have some, you know, have some muscle to flex in a way that those groups certainly don't. And as a consequence of that, you know, woe betide any chancellor who's tried to unfreeze fuel duty ever since. It's become very, very significant. So you definitely get a sense in which various different people from various different walks of life, but kind of united by the fact that they do work in that real economy, they do really matter, but not treated as such, are sort of finding their voice, are coming together. We saw it with the Gilets Jaunes, we've seen it with the farmers' protests, we saw it with the truckers' revolt, although that was in the context of COVID. I think it had many of the similar sort of features to it. And the other thing that's fascinating, but also quite repetitive about the way in which these movements are being received by the various governments that they're protesting against, is just the reflexive alt-right, far-right slur, which is being thrown at them in every single situation. And I think that's been really, really revealing. I mean, there was one article in The Guardian which talked about not just these farming protests, but also various other sort of strikes that are going on and industrial action that's going on in Germany. I think the railways have been striking this week. There's also been various hauliers who are in open revolt against various kind of road charges and things like this. And the headline or the standfirst was something along the lines of strikes in Germany could be opportunity for the far right, which I think tells you something about, on the one hand, any time that you have working class people, kind of lower middle class people, the kind of unglamorous people of the economy and society, revolt against the establishment, it's now instantly greeted with, oh, the fascists are here, which I think is very telling. But also how these movements are completely divorced from the left in general. They don't seem to be particularly interested in them. They can't lead them even if they wanted to. And they tend to fall in behind with various members of the kind of more centrist establishment, with condemning them as just, you know, the AfD in tractors, as seems to have been the case in Germany at this point. So it's really fascinating about these protests, how we're seeing them crop up everywhere, but also how they seem to be eliciting almost exactly the same scornful response from every government that they're agitating against.
And I think it is fascinating to see these kinds of revolts crop up in Germany, because, you know, it is one of those countries, as you said, Tom, it's not a country that normally revolts, but even the rise of the AfD is very unexpected. A couple of years ago, even during COVID, people were saying Germany is a country that's got everything right. You know, they've followed the exact kind of every sort of liberal playbook that every bien pensant centrist thinks it's an amazing country and it's so beautifully governed. And now everything's falling apart. You know, it's deindustrializing thanks to high energy costs. Everyone is on strike this week. You know, they can't grow enough food because of the farmers are in revolt. I mean, Simon, do you think there's something in that? You know, the way this is, Germany should be the model, it's supposed to be the model country for our own political class, but it's all gone a bit wrong quite quickly.
It's interesting, isn't it? It does remind you a little bit of Man United after Alex Ferguson left. You know, they held on for as long as they could with Angela Merkel, and they were aware that they had a pretty unusual talent there, although, of course, a lot of the problems they're now facing were, you know, sown by her. But it is, yeah, you're right. There was a famous book, wasn't there? Something about Germany, you know, why Germany is a grown-up country or something, and how we can all benefit from it.
Yeah,
or,
Germans, you know, do it better, kind of, yeah.
I mean, I'm interested in that aspect of things going wrong. And obviously the iconic moment in that regard was Donald Trump telling Germany that it was putting too many of its eggs in the Russian energy basket, and the famous clip of high-ranking, sophisticated, well-dressed people in sort of grey cashmere laughing down their noses at this ridiculous buffoon, and that turning out to be true very, very quickly. There is also that thing which Tom hinted at, which in particular seems to affect all modern political leadership when they are confronted by men who drive large vehicles protesting, that they immediately reach for the far right epithet. And that is quite a new thing. It used to be, I certainly remember, maybe I'm going back further than I realise, because obviously when you get to a certain age, the time becomes very contingent. But I remember, generally speaking, you know, protesters were usually categorised and dismissed as far left, commie agitators, that sort of thing. But almost every trucking rally, well, the Gilets Jaunes, obviously, in Canada, the famous protest which was against vaccination passports and so on, which Trudeau tried to characterise as racist and far right and fascist. It's an extraordinary leap to claim that anyone who is simply trying to resist really quite radical progressive change, you know, must therefore be hard right. I just don't think it washes. I don't think anyone's buying that at all. And I think that's a really wrong-headed way of trying to, apart from anything else, and I read this in Spike's own recent article on it, I wouldn't have had it at my fingertips otherwise, but they know the voting intentions of most of these drivers, farmers, and they are, broadly speaking, centre-right, Christian Democrats, that sort of thing. They're not socialists, but, they're hard-working people who know the value of a mark or a euro, but they're certainly not. There's no kind of anti-immigrant sort of side to this, which is obviously what hard right, far right means now in Europe. It's not an economic proposition; it's about race. So it's just ridiculous, extraordinary smear a campaign.
This week, the UK government has announced new legislation to exonerate the 900 or so sub postmasters who were wrongfully convicted in the Post Office Horizon scandal. Now, Tom, a lot of people have remarked on the fact that it's taken seemingly forever for these sub-postmasters to get any kind of justice. I mean, the first wrongful convictions were in 1999. Attention was brought to the faults of the Horizon IT system in 2003 in the courts. And yet here it is, 2024, it's taken for this to really capture the attention of the political class. I mean, what have you made of that?
I think that's been the number one question, hasn't it, really? Because obviously at this point, it now seems like there is going to be redress. There is going to be an attempt to right the wrongs. Obviously, that's going to be a pretty fraught process, given the fact they're having to pass some quite unprecedented legislation to try and start to deal with this problem. And even so, there were people who fall through the cracks. But the fact that it took that long, because that's what many of the sub-postmasters will really complain about most, is the fact that this is, in some of their cases, more than a decade, 15 years of their life just completely ruined as a consequence of a computer telling them that they were a thief and the authorities siding with the computer, effectively. Mm. It's not to say that it wasn't reported on. I think that's one thing that's worth saying. I mean, Private Eye did some great stuff on it. There was even some numbers people put out, the number of articles that various newspapers have written about it. It wasn't underreported on necessarily. What was fascinating was that it never really caught fire politically. No opposition ever jumped on it. And in the context of the sorts of scandals that we've become accustomed to in recent years, you know, most famously, you know, Boris Johnson, who finally opened the inquiry into this back in 2020, was brought down because he ate cake at the wrong time with the wrong people or whatever. It kind of gives you a sense of how trivial our political class is, or how cut off they are from the people that they're supposed to represent. It seems like it's one of those issues where it combines the fact that it deals with a group of people who are kind of unglamorous as far as the political class and to some extent the media are concerned. These kind of lower middle class, small business people, you know, save enough money to invest in something like their own post office, and then get completely put through the ringer. It's also quite a complicated story. It's not something you can fire off a quick Twitter thread about or do a kind of sassy, you know, social media message or intervention at Prime Minister's questions and get loads of high fives for doing so. It takes a while to explain what has gone on, the backstory and so on. But at the same time, as soon as you explain it to anyone, the profound injustice of it is so apparent. It's incredible that it fell to really just a handful of backbenchers to properly pursue this. But I think it just really speaks to that chasm that exists between what we assume politicians should do, such as righting wrongs like this, taking up issues when their constituents get in contact with them about horrendous things that are taking place, and what they actually do, which is a lot of party political manoeuvring and, as I say, just making sassy interventions in the chamber. But also that kind of sense that people quite understandably kind of assume that things like this really shouldn't happen, certainly shouldn't happen on the scale in which they've taken place. You had literally hundreds of people in this instance who were having to sort of do battle with this system, a sclerotic legal system, a sort of strange combination of the state and these various companies. No justice whatsoever. People being sent to prison. There was one woman who was sent to prison whilst pregnant.
Mm.
The only evidence against her, supposedly, for this theft was the fact that the computer had said that she'd stolen it. There was no other evidence whatsoever, and yet they didn't believe her. So it's a really damning indictment, definitely, of our politics, to a certain extent on media, but as I say, I don't think they dropped the ball nearly as much as anyone else. And a kind of sense of who really matters in society and what issues matter and how trivial a lot of things have become. I think it's a kind of potent cocktail of a lot of those things.
Yeah, Simon, what have you made of this? I mean, particularly, do you think the victims are just the wrong kind of victims? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about that.
Well, obviously, at some point, there was a sense they were the wrong kind of victims. But in terms of the ITV drama, of course, they were exactly the right kind of victims, because I think everyone felt an extraordinary sympathy and empathy with them. We watched three of the four episodes last night, funnily enough, before I knew I was going to be doing this podcast. So that was lucky. And very gripping, very well done, felt very authentic. Most of the casting seemed to have been done to attempt to capture the reality rather than have a sort of Netflix rewrite kind of version of events. And I think both my wife and myself felt quite moved and angry on these people's behalf. You know, it felt very much like the sort of thing you could imagine yourself getting tangled up in. Every so often, I mean, I have on a smaller scale at the moment an ongoing dispute with a private parking contractor, one of these people who catch you overstaying your welcome in a service station, you know, and then start sending you ever-escalating fines before you know what you're doing. There's no one you can reply to. There's a lot of that in the modern world, and I think a lot of people recognise, watching that Horizon processing unit sitting under the desk in the post office, the sub post office counters, I think, oh, God, I've felt a certain kind of anxiety because there are things like that in my life, you know, and you just think, if that started to go wrong, I don't know what I would do, and I can imagine it happening. So in a funny way, although it didn't like catch light like a plane crash, you know, due to faulty software or air traffic control going down or something, obviously it felt like it was quite local paper kind of territory initially. Actually now it has caught a lot of people's imagination, because I think it speaks to a certain kind of anxiety that we all have, that automation is taking over. It's very rarely as accountable as we might like. The helplines are very rarely as helpful as you might hope, and it really could have been any one of us. It's very relatable, let's say that, you know. And also, of course, there has been excellent journalism rumbling on in the background. As other people have said, Computer Weekly, funnily enough, deserves some of the credit.
Definitely. And Tom, in terms of sort of political ramifications, it has brought people like Ed Davey and Keir Starmer to a lesser extent into the spotlight. Their, you know, roles have been questioned. I mean, should talk a bit about Ed Davey, first of all, particularly as he is someone who is constantly calling for the resignations of anyone else who puts a foot wrong.
Yeah, I believe there was a Times piece the other day which enumerated all the various people he had called to resign over the course of the past 4 or 5 years. It's a very long list, all for the sorts of indiscretions which sort of pale in comparison to what he's being accused of. Now, his defence, and there's probably something in it, is the fact that, you know, I'm only looking at what I'm getting briefed. I mean, doesn't necessarily cover him in glory, but does speak to the fact that because of this relationship that obviously the post office has with the government, given the fact that the government is the sole shareholder and so on, that they were basically just blindly agreeing with everything that was being put before them, even though it's become very clear in recent days that the post office were aware of what was going on. Increasingly, it seems that people even within government were aware of what was going on to an extent. There's the other side to it, which has kind of come out today, is the fact that there was one of these sub-postmasters in his own constituency who had tried to contact him at least three times and got absolutely nowhere. Meanwhile, his life was just completely falling apart around him. But at the same time, I think it's important that there's an element of scapegoating doesn't creep in, not because I want to stand up for Ed Davey as such an upstanding politician or whatever. It's more the fact that there's this kind of lack of a recognition that this indifference towards these individuals and this indifference to large sections of society and the injustices that they suffer is not limited to Paula Venables at the post office or Ed Davey in Westminster. Mm. This is something that is much broader. And I think there's a little bit of a danger that when you have a big blow up like this, people just kind of ostentatiously outraged about all these issues for a couple of days and then mistake that for actually having any real social conscience or having any real concern about these issues. I think the worst thing that could possibly happen in this instance is that it does just become a story for a couple of weeks and then it goes away, because it's going to have a very long tail, it's going to be a very messy process, and even then there's going to be a lot of people who won't be properly compensated, if you even can be, for what's going on. So there's obviously a lot of questions that need to be answered. There's a lot of people who have really shown how, for all their kind of lofty talk of public life and the standards to which they seemingly hold other politicians when they supposedly they're kind of fundamentally failing to even stand up for their own constituents. I think it's important that this doesn't just become about this person needs to give back their CBE.
Yeah.
We should give Alan Bates a knighthood and everything will be fine. There's obviously a sort of much deeper problem, not just where this particular scandal is coming from, but that general indifference towards ordinary people, which I think has been exposed by this particular scandal.
Yeah, I mean, they solved all banking problems when they sacked that Fred the Shred fella, you know.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Just sack a few people and then move on. If you're anything like me, your New Year's resolutions usually don't make it to the third week of January. Actually sticking to all those positive habits can often end up feeling like a full-time job. But healthy living is supposed to give you more time and energy to enjoy your life, not less. That's why I've started drinking AG1. AG1 is my favourite practical daily nutrition supplement. Just one scoop contains 70 high-quality ingredients, all designed to meet your baseline nutritional needs. Starting off your day with AG1 is the best way to ensure that your body is taken care of, both physically and mentally. AG1 contains a broad spectrum of vitamins, from rhodiola to B vitamins. Those will keep you feeling sharp and focused throughout the day. You'll get that same kick of energy you normally get from caffeine, only without the crash later on in the day. One of the best things about AG1 is that it helps support my immune health. Ingredients like vitamin C, zinc, and functional mushrooms have helped me avoid some of those nasty seasonal colds. And that makes it even easier to stick to my other healthy habits. The biggest benefit of AG1 is that it's massively reduced my stress levels. It contains powerful plant extracts, adaptogenic herbs, and various antioxidants, which have made maintaining a constant workflow effortless. Keeping on top of everything has never been so easy. So if you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to drinkag1.com/spiked. That's drinkag1.com/spiked. Check it out. Let's talk about James Bond. So James Bond has been slapped with a trigger warning. Anyone who attends the new BFI season of Bond will learn that these films contain ideas and language that are of their time, shall we say. Simon, you wrote a really great column on this week. I mean, what have you made of it?
Well, it was interesting that a few people came forward and said, you know, there are elements in those Bond films that are not acceptable nowadays. And possibly, you know, because we've all sort of grown up with them, we have learned to take them with a pinch of salt. But if they're trying to attract young people to the cinema and they see James Bond, some people say very, very close to raping Pussy Galore in order to cure her of her lesbianism, that might be quite... I can understand that. I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit. I think what it is, as time goes on, there is a huge difference between those of us who have gradually learned to accommodate some of the more dated attitudes that appear in movies like that and some people who might be encountering old stuff for the first time. The season, I think, was actually intended to celebrate the career of the composer, John Barry, who created a lot of the most famous scores for Bond movies. And there are a few other films in there as well. I think the Ypres file and possibly some other Michael Caine stuff as well. And it's quite interesting in that regard, because John Barry's scores, which I love, I have, you know, a couple of CDs of his soundtracks, are emblematic of a certain kind of, you know, excitement about the sexual revolution at the time. And in a way, they are more emphatically dated, but I would say preferable to the kind of extraordinarily kind of grotesque musical displays that come out of, you know, American R&B and hip-hop and so on now, and yet seem to require no sort of trigger warning at all. You know, the kind of YouTube videos that really are very close to pornography and so on, both in their visual and lyrical content. Whereas John Barry's stuff, which, as I say, I think is the linking sort of principle in these movies, is incredibly sort of naive and upbeat and just swinging, baby. You know, it's Austin Powers, but it's, I do worry, as I said in the article, you know, I understand why some people might look at it and go, mate, if you don't care about trigger warnings, just let it wash over you. It's 3 seconds on the screen before the movie starts. And I understand why people might think I'm just being a harumphing old bore about it. But as I said in the article, the worry is that the more we bend over to try and accommodate people's vulnerability, weakness, mental fragility, the more fragile they become. You know, that all the evidence supports that concern, that we have raised a generation, couple of generations now, who were not allowed to play outside, who were not allowed to form gangs, who were not allowed to play doctors and nurses, and, you know, who have been sort of raised almost in laboratory circumstances. And it's, you know, it's not looking great at the moment, to be honest. As an experiment, you would probably say it's failed in that particular respect. And perhaps we need to start exposing them to the sort of impacts that would actually help their immune system to grow again.
The assumption behind these trigger warnings is that you will absolutely be offended by this, and you need to steel yourself before you see James Bond, you know, doing a Chinese impression or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, there are, we can all agree, mm-hmm, that there are some choice moments in those films, but are they likely to precipitate a mental health episode?
Why does it matter in the grand scheme of things? I think it's something that you might remark upon in a kind of film studies lesson, or you know, a younger member of your family might recoil slightly at some of the language used, but it really wouldn't previously have gone much further than that, because these things shouldn't ultimately matter too much. But I think what you're saying there, Fraser, points to one of the reasons why it is worth taking these things up. Because on the one hand, these trigger warnings, yes, they are fleeting. What difference does it make? They do hold the entire audience in contempt to some degree. If you very much kind of casting, particularly young people, they seem to be aimed at, as so fragile that they can't even engage with a piece of culture that was produced, you know, longer than 5 years ago. That's very irritating. I think the other thing about these trigger warnings and the fact that they're being slapped on films, increasingly books and novels. I mean, there was a kind of spate of stories recently about, you know, Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse getting a trigger warning about it might reflect attitudes that are no longer acceptable today, given that it's a novel about kind of an upper crust family going on their holidays. It does, you know, it does, there's not a hell of a lot in there. It's not like they suddenly black up halfway through it, but nevertheless, that was put on there. I think this thing that you increasingly see happening with culture, and I think particularly when it happens to popular culture of a certain vintage, I think another reason it grates on people is because there's this kind of implied contemptuous attitude to the sorts of things that people who are still bopping around, not necessarily that old, culture that they also enjoyed.
Yeah.
You know, so I think a lot of this, these trigger warnings and the kind of the standing in judgment, stern judgment of something like a James Bond film from 30 or 40 years ago, I think people are also interpreting it as part of that broader kind of cultural condescension against people and for the things that they like and for the TV and the films that they used to enjoy and so on. So I think that there are reasons to oppose it. But also, as Simon said, the fundamental thing is it's obviously having the opposite effect if these things are supposedly to protect against vulnerability and fragility amongst the population. It's clearly feeding it. I mean, trigger warnings were always supposed to be, when they were first sort of came up with and you'd see them crop up on university campuses, it was very specifically supposed to be about people with PTSD or something.
Yeah.
And even on those terms, you know, various psychologists have pointed out it fails because you shouldn't kind of wrap someone in cotton wool to try and protect them from their own particular actual triggers. But the fact that that's now been extrapolated to all of society is obviously having the effect that you're talking about, Simon. So if that's the point of it, which is to make sure that people aren't... you know, that we don't have this kind of society in which people fly off the handle. It's having the completely opposite effect.
Can I just add something as well that's occurring to me, like, listening to you talk, and I think it's absolutely right, but it's interesting. We're having a sort of quasi-academic discussion about it, and I think that's the tone these things set, isn't it? And it's almost unthinkable, even if young people did want to go along to the BFI to watch a Bond movie or one of the other Barry movies and just enjoy it and, like, sink into that experience, the very fact that there are trigger warnings at the beginning almost precludes the possibility of them just sitting back and enjoying it, let alone laughing out loud or feeling some excitement. They're more expected to treat it as if they're visiting a gallery and looking at some photojournalism from Biafra or something. You can't, you know, they're looking at one of the horrors of the 60s, one of the terrible, you know, artifacts of unreconstructed masculinity before we got a handle on it. And that's a terrible shame, you know. They should be celebrating the music, the fashion, the Devil May Care attitudes. But anyone who laughed out loud, it's similar. I know as a comedian, of course, as soon as you create the possibility that other people in the room might be offended, that's it. It's over. You know, you cannot enjoy the thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, trigger warnings are not in a censorship in and of themselves, but they do also create a climate of censorship. Mm-hmm. I mean, I almost think they're a little bit like on those maps where you see here be dragons.
Yeah.
You know, don't go there. This is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've also seen a similar phenomenon with older texts, is the sort of rewriting by sensitivity readers.
Mm-hmm.
These phenomena are all of a piece, even if trigger warnings are not directly censorious.
No, definitely. I think Simon described it so well as well. It becomes this kind of obstacle between you and the artwork, or you, a kind of barrier between you and what it is that you're supposed to actually be engaging in. And it casts it in a kind of suspicious light. You know, it suggests, as you saying there, Simon, that it's at best it's a kind of like artifact of some bigotry that we should just examine and learn from rather than actually enjoy in any meaningful sense. And I think it is bound up with a general kind of discomfort, not just with the potential of art and literature to shock or whatever, but also just this profound discomfort we have even with the relatively recent past. You know, these trigger warnings, it's seemingly kind of slapped on anything that wasn't made 5 minutes ago. And just seems to be that any kind of scant reminder of an era in which our, even just our, you know, whether the topics that might be discussed, the kind of stereotypes that might be bandied around, some of just the language maybe being used, a lack of representation or diversity as is currently being talked about, is so toxic and corrupting that you need to be, if not insulated from it completely, at least heavily warned about. I think just speaks to that real discomfort with any kind of vestige of how society used to be. And it's just odd because this sense that the bad old days, it now seems to reach up until at least the 2000s.
Yeah.
And that's a recent development, it feels like.
That was
and
when Russell Brand was rampaging around.
No, exactly. There's a lot of articles around that. Maybe I didn't realise it reached that far. But as you're saying, Simon, like culturally and historically, young people in particular are being encouraged to believe that there's nothing salvageable or enjoyable whatsoever from before then, and considering the kind of cultural and to a certain extent political wasteland we've been living in for quite some time, that's a very strange attitude to adopt, I think.
I mean, you see it a lot. There's a conversation going on at the moment about between Joey Barton and the rest of the world of football about whether or not female commentators know what they're talking about and so on. Now, I don't really follow football and I don't have any well-informed view on that, and I know some people who are keen on football, men who were fine with the female commentators, so I'm not sort of saying it's, you know, it's a slam dunk case, but there is again an attempt to present a view that he has that's a slightly old fashioned attitude towards the thing as deranged. I mean, I have literally seen that word used in The Guardian. There's a guy called Jonathan Yu or something, I think his name is, who wrote a column about ranting on Twitter about these women, saying that he's, you know, incoherent, you know, as if he was foaming at the mouth. Well, really, he has a view which was completely normal not very long ago, which is that men's football should be commentated on by men, you know, and I suspect there are millions of men who still hold to that view. And there's a similar thing with the Bond movies, that they represent a worldview which was pretty predominant, you know, or at least a slightly lurid version of it, but the underpinning sensibilities were there, that there are, you know, that it is a dream that most men have to be given an Aston Martin and a snug-nosed little pistol and a license to use it without application for authority, and to go out and traverse five continents and solve the world's problems. You know, this is a fantasy that it was pretty, universal until very, very recently. And we're now really anxious, I think, about even having any more James Bond movies, even within the constraints that were applied by, you know, hiring Fleabag and having all sorts of, you know, subplots concerning familial responsibility and so on in the last ridiculously intertwined five episodes. I think that's kind of sad. And it is only, of course, it always has to be said, but it is only the artistic and cultural artifacts of the West that are being treated this way. Nobody is going to give you a trigger warning before you read some South American literature or even ancient Greek, you know, or Chinese, or the various animations that you know, are popular in the Far East. These are all still considered to have their own code and to be, you know, entitled to pursue those beliefs with freedom, whereas the evil West is beyond redemption.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.